Good evening, James McCanny here with my Science Hour. This is for May 24th, 2018. Main science topic tonight, I'll be talking about propulsion systems. I'll also be talking about solid state batteries. Very important topic in the news. And I'll be talking about the next great discovery that I just feel that we're on the verge of this. So that's why I'm going to talk about it. And briefly, we all know about the heat that's generated in electric batteries. For example, on your computer, there have been fires in airplanes caused by cell phones. Cell phones have blown up because of overheating. I don't know which brand it was, but there was a computer a couple years ago that was catching on fire because the battery was overheating. They did not have proper cooling, etc. But anyway, where does that heat come from? Why do batteries heat up when they discharge and give you energy? And how much does that cost in energy? And if you could cure that problem, what would that mean to our world? And that's the core question. So I'll be coming back to that. And also propulsion systems, very interesting. And by the way, I'll be talking a lot more about propulsion systems in my paid cast, where I'm now talking about Atlantis to Tesla, the Colburn connection, and to put my propulsion systems into perspective, which are non-inertial, you have to understand propulsion systems in general, jet engines, rocket engines, ramjets, scramjets, other types of propulsion, nuclear-powered rockets, the list goes on. Ion engines, etc. So if you understand those types of propulsion systems, then when I introduce mine, you're going to go, wow, this guy once again is ahead of the curve. And remember that my propulsion system I introduced in 1982. That might be before some of you were born. That might be before some of your parents were born. Anyway, for some of you. So at any rate, that's tonight's main science topic, and I'll be kind of rounding that out. But anyway, I just want to reiterate a couple of side topics quickly, that it's very clear that the deep state is very involved in foreign politics. Now, the North Korea deal seems to be falling apart when it was very much on the table before. And I just smell a rat in the soup. Because Kim Jong-un was very hot on this deal, like a little kid with a new toy. And now all of a sudden, he's not so hot on it anymore. And the only way that the Democrats can win anything is by trying to shut down Trump. And we'll see. We'll see what happens here. But I would just say there's a mouse in the soup? What other expressions could you use? Because, now let me just tell you something, a little intel I got in this past week. That, remember James Comey, head of the FBI under Obama, you know, the Hillary Clinton email forgiving before they even did an investigation and all of that. Well, it turns out the intel that I've gotten is out of Brazil. And it turns out that James Comey, as FBI director under Obama, was instrumental in ousting the duly elected president of Brazil. And this happened last summer during the Summer Olympics. They staged a coup. They came in. They dragged the guy out of his office, threw him in jail, accused him of, you know, collusion or some type of... No, they actually accused him of some kind of financial crimes. And... Not that the people that were in before him, he got in office because of a popular vote, an extremely popular vote, and that began what was known as the BRICS nations, Remember, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and Spain were what we called the BRICS nations. South Africa. So it was Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa formed a banking alliance. And, of course, this was against the concept of the World Bank, because the World Bank basically had all of these countries under its banking thumb. So they began their own SWIFT system for doing international transfers, trading out of the petrodollar, for one thing. So anyway, and that's a complicated issue, but the president of Brazil was ousted, and it turns out that Jim Comey, head of the FBI, now the FBI is only supposed to deal with internal affairs inside the United States. So what's James Comey doing, working with the coup in Brazil to topple a legally, legitimately elected president, and who was very popular? And then after that came a banking purge and other types of post-coup type of discrimination against those who opposed the coup government. And also it was run and controlled by the military junta. I mean, this is getting back to the 1960s Noriega, or, you know, the 1980s Noriega in Panama, etc. And Ecuador, where the CIA killed the sitting president, literally killed him and his family in an airplane crash. This is publicly available knowledge now. It's been released. The files have been released. And drug Ecuador into basically 20 years of destitute situation with the fruit and the sugar companies running that country, until Correa won by a popular election and turned the country around and is building it up to what it is today, an energy independent, water independent, food independent country. So I diverge just a little bit here. But it's very clear that the United States is deep state, that is deep in the politics, especially in South America, in other countries. Remember Egypt, how they were over there trying to muck things up, and the people came along and threw the CIA candidate out of office, took their country back, etc. So anyway, but this is still going on today in the world we live in. And there's two major South American elections coming up very shortly, so you might want to keep an eye on those. And all I'm saying is, when it comes to North Korea, the fact that Kim over there was, like I say, a school kid with a brand new toy, and all of a sudden he's turning cold on the nuclear deal, somebody is in there mucking this up. And remember John Kerry going over to Iran and going to Europe and meeting with world leaders and saying, hey, don't worry about this Iran deal. Just keep it in place. Then because he basically stating that he didn't think Trump would be around very long because of the Mueller investigation. Anyway, and just one other point about Kerry going to Iran, telling them to try and save the nuclear deal that was made under the Obama regime when Kerry was Secretary of State. But interestingly enough, the Iranians now, because Trump pulled out of the deal, they're saying they want their money back. They paid bribes to Obama administration officials to put that nuclear deal in place. And I'll just reiterate this. This is the most important part of that so-called Iranian deal with John Kerry and the Obama administration, is that not only did they release the holding funds that had been held in sanction, but they also gave hundreds of billions of dollars in cash to the Iranian government. And this is not, this is just the beginning. This is the tip of the iceberg. And some of that money went into kickbacks to Kerry and Obama and other people in and Hillary Clinton and the Clinton Foundation. All of this money got kicked back, not all of it, but a good chunk of it. And so now that Trump has pulled out, Iran is saying, hey, you guys promised us this deal, and now you're not complying with it. That's why Kerry is over there, because if Iran exposes the people, which it's threatened to do, it says, if you can't maintain this deal, we're going to expose the people in the U.S. government that got the kickbacks. Anyway, it's getting pretty muddy out there. And it's worth noting, too, that in the Mueller probe, they were going after Alex Jones and Roger Stone, who is a regular host, guest host or whatever you want to call, on the Alex Jones show. And so, interesting, they're trying, that seems to be their last-ditch effort to try and point the finger to Alex Jones, which to me is bizarre. Alex Jones had a big effect on the election. A lot of people learned the true nature of, say, Hillary Clinton and the Clinton Foundation and the skullduggery in the Democratic Party through Alex Jones. And, of course, Roger Stone, who was a longtime political person in D.C. So it looks like they're trying to target them to neutralize them. But if you you know anything about Alex Jones, whether you like him or don't like him, this is not the issue. If you do something like that to Alex Jones, he feeds off of this. They don't understand who Alex Jones is. Like I say, I don't care if you like him or don't like him. But if you do something negative to Alex Jones, he's going to puff up his chest like a gorilla and pound on it and go stamping through the jungle. So anyway, and a lot of you people out there learned a lot of information, and he was influential in the last election, and I'll say that. But not because of some Russia link, because he's just Alex Jones, and he's out there getting information. He has, because of who he is, he's got a lot of information sources, and he tends to be right about 99.9% of the time. And he stays away from certain topics politically, but the guy is walking a tightrope being who he is. So being a totally independent news source that doesn't depend on some big money person stuffing money in his back pocket. You know, he sells stuff on his internet store like I do. I don't have a source of somebody sticking money in my back pocket. But this is what independent news is about. And we don't, you know, if you take all the people in independent news, like, say, myself or, say, John Moore or, say, you know, the Power Hour or Alex Jones or Hannity or the other big names in news, I'm probably one of the smaller people on the list, but I've been around and most people know my name, certainly. And I've been guest a couple times in the last year on Alex Jones. I think three times I was called in to do commentary on hurricanes and some other issues. But, in terms of my show, et cetera, I'm kind of maybe small potatoes on the list, but all of us, and if you put all of these people in the same room at the same time, they probably wouldn't agree 100% on everything, but they're trying to move the ship in the same direction. So anyway, I want to encourage people, and this is as political as I will get, I want to encourage people to pay attention to this midterm election that's coming up. It's really, really an important one, and it's already becoming an eye-opener in that the people are turning out in the Republicans are turning out in much greater numbers at the primaries, which is an indication of something. And the Republicans who are winning the primaries are Trump supporters, are their vocal Trump supporters. And the people who are like middle of the road or want to sway towards Democratic values, those Republicans are not making it into the primaries for this midterm election. And there's a lot of Democratic seats that are up for grabs here. And so I'm not going to go through all the statistics here, but this is a very interesting midterm election. And I suggest that you follow it. I have been on John Moore's show yesterday morning. I gave a recommendation to people to follow a woman in Florida. Now, this is a woman that's a Republican now running for the Republican candidate in this district where Debbie Wasserman Schultz is. And if you remember, she was the Democratic National Committee chairwoman who had to step down because of corruption, of throwing the election towards Hillary Clinton and taking the money of Bernie Sanders supporters and throwing it into Hillary Clinton before Hillary Clinton had gotten the nomination. And so she had to step down. And there's a lot of other funny business that have gone on, like dead people in her district, and not to mention the Parkland school shooting was right there in Debbie's backyard. But anyway, this woman is who's running on the Republican ticket, her name is Carla Spalding. And so I want you to watch her, because that's a very key location. Here's the person who is the top person in the Democratic National Committee. Debbie Wasserman Schultz, Democrat, is running for office again and being opposed by a woman, black woman, who is a Navy veteran, nurse, single mother, clean as a whistle record, no corruption in her life. And so anyway, this is going to be an interesting race. So anyway, I'm just saying, check this out. Look at who's winning. Look at the primaries. Look at who's winning in the primaries. Look at the number of Republicans that are showing up to the primaries as opposed to Democrats. And if that's any indication of voting, then, and also the fact that the Republican candidates that are making it through the primaries and will be running on the fall ticket for the midterm elections are Trump supporters, pretty much 100% of them. And so and they're very vocal. So that means the public is choosing Trump supporters in the Republican Party to run against Democrats. And I'll just add one little issue here, that when I did my voting analysis, remember I did a number of radio shows on this show and on the Power Hour and other shows where I talked about my analysis of the 2016 presidential election. And I gave the 10 top ways to cheat in the election. And then after the election, I found one more, which came out of the Jill Stein recount. And that additional method was where they actually changed the numbers at the voting precinct. After all the votes were in, after they were counted, they simply wrote down a number. They doubled and tripled, in some cases, Hillary Clinton's numbers, like in Milwaukee and in over 900 precincts in Detroit, in many hundreds of precincts in Philadelphia. And they simply doubled and tripled Hillary Clinton's numbers, and she still lost those states. So anyway, it just shows that, and also Denver was another site, Las Vegas was another site, Los Angeles, Chicago. This is going to be very interesting, because quite a few of the elections coming up are in the what I call cheating zones, where the Democrats can pull out a tremendous number of cheating votes. So anyway, just something to be aware of there. Okay, on to this next topic. Wow, this one hit me right between the eyes. This is an amazing story. Now, I'm sure you've all seen in the news and the press about the volcanic activity in Hawaii. Now, the Hawaiian Islands are volcanic, of course, and the there's seven large islands. I shouldn't say big, because big island refers to the biggest island, which is the island of Hawaii. And so the state of Hawaii has basically seven islands. And the only really active volcano, in spite of the fact that Maui has a volcano called Haleakala, which is not really active. I don't know when the last time it was active, but certainly not in geological time. But Hawaii, the big island, has the world's most active volcano. It's called Kilauea. And it is literally been active since, you know, the Hawaiians landed there who knows when, you know, thousands of years ago. But it erupted recently and destroyed a lot of houses. Now, in spite of the fact that this is a tragedy and a great loss of house, etc., I think one guy that I heard about got hurt or something, read about this in the news. He was sitting on his porch when lava erupted in his front yard. But to be clear, these people built their houses basically in a lava flow area where, you know, 20 and 40 years ago, this area was erupting with lava. Somebody said that even after somebody's house was destroyed there in this recent evolution of volcanic flows, etc., which has now, by the way, crossed the highway and gone down and reached the ocean. But somebody began rebuilding his house on the same lot that his old house had been torched, was rebuilding on the lava that just freshly came in. Now, hello? If you build your house in a floodplain or a lava, worse, in a lava flow, I don't know what's better or worse, but this is a tragedy, but it's something that was very much predictable. You just should not build houses, and nobody should have let these housing communities be built there in down below the world's most active volcano. Hello? You know, excuse me. But this week, now this is a report coming out from John Rappaport. John, I've been on his show, and he interviewed me. We've communicated a bit, not a lot. I mean, I haven't communicated with him for a long time, but he's right on. He comes up with these stories and really does some hard-hitting, very factual, digging into these stories type of reporting. So what the story, this is somebody sent me, John Rappaport reporting that fracking may have caused this volcanic eruption. Now, there's a company there on the Big Island of Hawaii at the volcano that is a geothermal company. In other words, they're garnering electricity geothermally. And the way this is done is you put a hole down into the ground. You drill this down, and I'm sure it has a pipe that holds the dirt from falling into it. But they put a tube down into the ground 5 kilometers down. Now, you do this by a volcano, you're down to some pretty mean, ugly, hot, molten rock. Another term for that is magma. But at any rate, the name of this company, according to John Rappaport, is Puna Geothermal Ventures. And it's a part of a holding company, which is a subsidiary. And I'm not going to go through all of this detail, but the question is, now, to describe what fracking involves, fracking takes various forms. One form is like out in South Dakota, where they put liquid down in the ground, and then they set explosive charges behind that and explode down in the ground, and that pushes the water, causes an impulse, and forces the natural gas out. And I've talked about this before on my show, where the natural gas prices are falling because of fracking. and down in Oklahoma, etc., but that in a five-year period, once fracking becomes ineffective, then the prices of natural gas is going to soar. The natural gas low prices are causing the coal-fired power plants to go out of business one by one. And so when natural gas prices climb, the low electricity prices that people are enjoying due to natural gas and the conversion of some power plants to natural gas at great expense, which of course you, the consumer, would be paying for, there's no way to convert back to coal at that point. So then electrical prices are going to skyrocket. And the it's setting the stage for the wind generator to come in, because these power companies simply are not going to be able to sell electricity. And so by selling electrical energy from the wind with efficient, these are not the stupid three-blade wind generators, these are efficient wind generators that really do extract energy from the wind to provide distributed power around the country. These nuclear power plants are on the fringe. And oh, by the way, I'm getting into all these other topics. I got the scoop, the baseball, on the San Onofre nuclear power plant out in San Diego, and I never knew what happened there. Well, I got the message from an insider that I came into contact this last week, somebody that actually worked in the San Onofre plant and had detailed knowledge of why it got shut down. And so I always thought, was there a nuclear accident? Was there something else that happened there? And so it turns out that Southern California Edison, who is the subsidiary of International Edison Corporation, the Southern California Edison, ordered new generators. These are the power generators. This is the machine that they rotate with the steam from the turbines in the nuclear power plant. And they brought these massive generators in. They were made by Toshiba. Heavy Industries was the word in Japan. And so anyway, they brought them in, and it turns out that whoever had spec'd them out, and apparently there was a bit of litigation over this, but it turns out that it was actually the fault of Southern California Edison staff who gave the wrong specifications. And so they got up and ran them for a while, but they didn't work. And so basically they had to shut that plant down because the cost of replacing them was just over the top. So they had to shut the plant down. $5 billion to decommission that nuclear power plant, San Onofre, California. And that is what happened. So that's the, as they say, inside baseball, the scoop on San Onofre. And anyway, okay, so but going back to the issue of fracking, what they do, there's various types of methods of fracking. In some cases, they just pump water down into the ground, sometimes with chemicals, depending on what they're doing. And by the way, lithium, which you use in batteries in your phone and your computer, etc., lithium ion, the lithium, and it's also in automobiles now, lithium ion batteries, or the Tesla Powerwall, for example, is lithium ion. So the lithium typically does not come from like veins like silver or gold or platinum or other types of rare metals. A lot of times come in veins, but the lithium does not. It's in like a powder form. It's kind of like uranium. You have to dig up a big area and then extract the holding material that's holding the lithium, and then there's a finer extraction process. But fracking is used also to get lithium out of the ground. But in Hawaii, they were pumping water down into the ground, into this tube that goes 5 kilometers down, and there is evidence that that is what caused the violent volcanic eruptions that are going on in Hawaii right now. Now, the last thing you should be doing around a volcano is pumping water into it. Remember, NASA came out with the bright idea that they were going to cool down the Yellowstone volcano by pumping cold water into this tube that they were going to drill down into the volcano. And all that would do is cause explosions, and once the explosions got bigger, the lake at Yellowstone would fall down into, hit that magma, and would blow the top off and create a super volcano that would destroy not only the United States, but pretty much the whole world. So that's NASA's solution, and my solution is to get the water out of there. So in spite of the fact that I have been preaching all of these years that water is the source of explosive activity around volcanoes, geologists didn't think that. They thought the explosive gases just came up out of the ground and decided to explode, like Mount St. Helens takes the top of the mountain off one day. At any rate, now geologists are beginning to recognize that steam is actually the cause of volcanic violent eruptions. And so here you've got a company that's pumping water down into a volcano, which is causing it to erupt. And there's some lawsuits, there's some litigation beginning. And this company, the holding company, let me see the name. And you know how it is with names. It's called Ormat Technologies. And it turns out that our good buddy Democrat Harry Reid from Nevada is involved in this, as are some other politicians, who got this company $139 million, $139 million, out of a fund that was supposed to go towards green energy. And so anyway, there are lawsuits now involved trying to get this money back from this company that basically sold the government a bill of goods, and it was promoted by Harry Reid, the guy that had the Bundys arrested and thrown off their property because he wanted their land. Oh man, these people just have no end to the corruption and the defugalities they're causing. But this is a company that potentially, and I believe it's true, I personally give my 100% stamp of approval that they caused this volcanic eruption. And so that volcano was benign. It was just sitting there. This company is pumping water into a live volcano, causing it to erupt. Okay, I don't want to spend a lot more time, but this main report came from John Rappaport on his page. And that page is called johnrappaport.wordpress.com. And you could just look up, it looks like this is a May 22nd, 2018 report in his blog. It's called, Did Fracking Cause the Hawaii Volcano Eruption? John Rappaport. Good work again, John. Just keep pounding the pavement there, because there's a guy that has exposed so many things and enlightened the public. Just my hats off to people like him and other people that are constantly out there bringing us real information. Okay, this next story is big news, and I started talking about this at the beginning of the show. I was talking about the fact that batteries, when you discharge a battery or take your car battery, what we call liquid battery or sulfuric acid battery, that when you discharge it, it heats up. And that's because the current is flowing through, and then the chemical reaction or the reaction in, like in lithium ion batteries, etc. So you have to cool the batteries if you're discharging them to any degree. Now, your flashlight battery really doesn't discharge that much current to heat them up extensively. But also, there are other properties relative to batteries. For example, internal discharge. If you leave a battery sitting there, there's an internal resistance, And the battery literally discharges within itself. That's why you got to start your car battery every now and then, is because you have to charge it up because it's internally discharging. So that's one of the properties. And lithium ion has a very low internal discharge rate. There's memory. In other words, how many times can you recharge the battery before it wears out and you can't recharge it up to 100% capacity anymore? How deep can you discharge the battery? A lot of like the deep discharge batteries, even though they call them deep discharge, you can only discharge them up to about 50% of their value, and then you have to charge them up again. You don't want to discharge them 100%, whereas the lithium ion batteries, you can discharge close to 100%, then charge them up and recharge them many times. So all of these properties regarding batteries. But what's preventing us from having much better mileage on, say, an automobile that's electric, pure electric with a battery? And right now, the Tesla automobiles are getting like 300 miles to a charge, which is phenomenal. I believe they're at the point where they're now actually cheaper to operate than a gasoline engine. And of course, maintenance is very low because you don't have the oil changes, you don't have all of the motor issues. You know, you have electric motors, they last a lot longer, they have much higher torque, they have much higher off-the-line power, etc. I mean, if you want to look at the specs of a car, look at the Tesla sports car. I forget what they call it, but it's got like a 300-mile range, or maybe it's a 600-mile range. I can't remember. I think that one might have like a 600-mile range. It has a top-end speed of 250 miles an hour, and it goes from 0 to 60 in like a second, 1.2 seconds or something ridiculous. I mean, you look at the specs on this thing, and, you know, an Indy 500 race car can't do this. But anyway, along with the tremendous power that comes out of these battery packs is heat, and they're giving off heat. So how much, you know, heat is a form of energy. So if you're heating up the battery and you have to cool it down, that takes energy. But if you could eliminate the heating of a battery during the discharge process, now you can extend the lifetime of the battery by maybe 10 times. There's a lot of heat energy that goes off in discharging that battery. So some people, there's a lot of research going on this. I saw a claim this week. Some people created a magnetic diode. Now, this all comes back to a diode. A diode is an electrical device which allows current to pass in one direction but blocks the current if it goes in the other direction. They have very interesting properties. They're part of rectifiers. They're parts of other, all kinds of electronic devices have diodes in them, including batteries, including solid-state batteries, etc. So the race is on. And the person or group or company that comes up with the solution that when the diodes flip and pass current, there's energy is expended, and that's where the heat comes from. Now, let me give you a little bit different example here. Remember the old incandescent light bulbs? You have the light bulb, it had the little metal filament in there. That's the original Edison light bulb. And what it is, it's a tungsten metal filament in there, and there's two little like wires that stick up, and then you have this little tungsten filament. And the tungsten filament, you run a AC current through there, or a DC current, whatever, and it lights up and gives off light. You light it up to the point where it's white hot, and it gives off light. But there's a tremendous amount of heat associated with the light. And sometimes you can talk about this in terms of infrared radiation or heat radiation, but heat is given off. And it turns out that for an incandescent light bulb, the old-fashioned screw-in light bulbs, the incandescent light bulb, 95% of the energy goes off as heat. and only 5% of the light goes off as visible light that's useful. So what somebody did, and this comes back to diode technology, they took a diode, and it's been known for a long time that diodes can be used to give off light. So that's where the LED comes from. That is significant because, once again, a diode technology. And an LED means light-emitting diode. So it's a diode that emits light. But what people found out by mistake, or I don't know whoever discovered this, but, okay, so you get a certain amount of light off the diode, but if you take a phosphorus coating and you put it on top of that light, it absorbs the light and then re-emits it, and it's almost acting like an amplifier. You get this tremendous amount of light off of this, but very little heat. So the LED light, which we're all using now, I'm sitting there, in fact, LED lights here, they're in your television, they produce a very bright light, and you can make them in different colors, etc. So the discovery of the LED lights that are very low power, now this is different than neon lights or other forms of lights that are used, like the little pigtail lights, etc. The LEDs are solid state. They don't require gas, which was the problem with the little pigtail lights. Because they were dangerous if they broke. But the LED is something that just runs forever. It's a solid-state device. It puts out a tremendous amount of light. It doesn't create heat. So you can run a light bulb now with the same amount of output of light, but with maybe a tenth the amount of electricity, because all that electricity that was going off in the form of heat now is not going off, is not created, because the diode doesn't, it creates a little bit of heat, but hardly any at all. The same is true of batteries. So the race is on, and I guarantee you, this is not a prediction, this is a promise, that within probably the next year, I would say within 5 years for sure, that's the outside window, probably within the next year, somebody is going to figure out how to create a diode that stores energy, and when it's released, it does not heat up. And there's a group that, like I say, created a magnetic diode. And any of these in-laboratory research ideas, once you've tried to make them practical, like there have been many other attempts at ionic types of batteries that like the lithium ion, but they had troubles, like say with the terminal, creating a terminal that can carry this massive amount of current out in discharging the battery or charging it up. So there's all kinds of other practical problems that you can run into when you're bringing something to market to mass produce, or is the material available enough. There's all kinds of battery inventions out there. There's the carbon, what is it, the C5 battery or C6, whatever it is, all of these. But people are zoning in on solutions. And the battery that is will be just like the LED light bulb. If you can create a diode that does not expend that amount of heat when it discharges, then you've got an engineering marvel. You better run to the patent office with that baby, because that is going to bring in. Now imagine a Tesla automobile or an electrical automobile that has a range not of 300 miles. I think the Tesla Roadster sedan has a mileage of about 300 miles. It can go without before recharging. What if you could extend that by a factor of 10, like we had with light bulbs? Literally, a light bulb, a LED light bulb, uses about one-tenth the amount of energy, where it used to be like a 100-watt light bulb, now has about maybe 10 watts to give you the same amount of light. But what if you could do that for a battery? And so a battery that will get you 300 miles, all of a sudden you're going to get 3,000 miles. Hey, buddy, now we're talking. But extend this to motorcycles, to trains, to your house, to having the wing generator provide energy and store it up in your house and use it very efficiently in your house. Everybody's got battery packs. And also for airplanes. And this is where the big advancement will be, because Airbus announced, I saw the president of Airbus a couple of years ago, announced that they were going full forward front into electric airplanes, and fully expected to have electric airplanes with 100 passenger airplanes in the air soon. And he admitted at the time, he said the change that has to come, the motors are there, the fan blade systems are there, the turbofans, the distribution, the design of the airplanes, everything is there. They just need that improvement in the batteries, and it's coming. It's right around the corner. And so we're going to be going to an electric world. And once again, I'm working on the wing generator, putting everything I have into that, because it's a very efficient way to get energy from the wind. And then when we start storing this up in mass, in other words, you might have an electric car. You come home, you plug the electric car in, but just like your, a camera, that's a good example. You've got your SLR, single lens reflex camera, Nikon or Canon, nice, expensive camera. And if you're traveling, you probably have two or three batteries that you carry with you. I always did. And so you'd take your pictures, you'd run out of the battery, you'd pop in another battery, you were good to go. You could put 1,000 photos in this camera. And, but the battery was the thing you had to replace, or maybe a memory card, so you'd carry in an extra memory card or two. And, you could take 2,000 or 3,000 photos in this camera. Remember the cameras, and maybe some of you don't, where you had a 12 or a 24 roll of film, and now you're taking 1,000 pictures on a camera. You don't even think about it. You're taking videos on a camera, storing it in memory. Okay, so anyway, the big breakthrough that's coming, I guarantee you, is going to be in terms of batteries, and it's going to be soon, and it's going to be a game changer, and when it does, the world is going to move one step closer to an electric world. Okay, so let me see what other topics I got quick here. Oh, and just quickly about that also, people I know have drones, these little, toy drones. Well, the technology is really getting advanced with those, and the people are already building them big enough so they can get on them and fly around. This is going to be the next step. Could you imagine your own private drone that's very stable? You get onto it, and are we about on the verge of having a magic carpet? In other words, can you imagine a vehicle that looks like, say, a flying saucer with a nice glass dome? You lift up the dome, you get in, you sit down on a couch. Inside, you've slapped the dome cover down. You power this thing up, and you lift off, and you take a 300-mile trip, and you get there in about an hour. Maybe you're going to go camp for the weekend with the family. And you get out, you have all your camping equipment there. It's certainly very lightweight camping equipment. But imagine this. This is the type of thing that's going to come with batteries that have a long, durable lifetime, a discharge rate that's 10 times what batteries have today. It's coming. It's right around the corner, and it's going to be a game changer. And it comes back to diodes. In fact, if I weren't so involved in the wing generator now, I might develop a lab and go in and start working on diodes, because that is where it's at. That's what I did for my advanced physics degree thesis. I worked on semiconductors for X-ray xerography, which is the taking X-rays with a film plate, electronic film plate, instead of the old X-ray plates, which were like photographic plates that were developed with chemicals. Now it's done electronically. And when I was at Tulane, I worked under a National Institute of Health grant, and that's what I did. I worked on, it's called polyvinyl carbosol, is the chemical, and it resulted in some patents that, I didn't get the patents, of course, because I was a graduate student, but people did have patent work come out of the work I did relative to visible light Xerox machines, and then some dealing with X-ray machines that take a picture of you when you break your arm or whatever, and you go to the doctor and you get an X-ray, and it comes out on an electronic plate, and it sends the photograph back to the lab. And when the next person comes in, they don't change out the X-ray plate. It's the same one. And so anyway, there's a very interesting technology there. So what I'm saying is, as a graduate student, I worked on semiconductors in my degree was in nuclear solid state physics. That's what my advanced physics degree is in. Okay, so I'm going to switch gears a little bit here, and this is going to be kind of a primer for the paid cast. Now, if you're not a member of my paid cast, it's $3.95 a month. And right now in my paid cast, starting in April and then May and then ongoing for, I don't know how long this is going to go on, probably quite a long time, I'm talking about my books. And so the paid cast is an extra hour every week. And right now, the current book I'm talking about is the Atlantis to Tesla, the Colburn Connection book. And so I'm going to have a special session in there about propulsion systems, because in the middle of my Atlantis to Tesla book is a paper that was published in the IEEE. I believe the full title is the Institute of Electronics and Electrical Engineers. And so anyway, back in the 80s, or actually the early 80s, when I started promoting this idea of a non-inertial propulsion system. And one of the big problems with flight of any kind, or rockets or propulsion or getting into outer space, one of the big problems is in what we call Newton's second law, that any action has an equal and opposite reaction. The principle of the jet engine, the rocket engine, the scramjet, the ion engine, etc., is that if you make something go fast in one direction, and you push against, comes out of a nozzle or something, then you move, or your rocket moves in the other direction. So that's when you see the rocket take off. It's got this big plume of smoke, because what they're doing is heating it up to a high temperature, forcing it out of a nozzle, and that pushes the rocket along. Or in the case of a jet engine, you have oxygen coming in, air coming in. It burns in the chamber and then comes out the back end, or the same principle of a propeller. A propeller has a motor connected to it. The propeller spins, forces the air to move fast, and that pushes the airplane along. Okay, so anyway, the reality that I came up with, and not that I came up with this part of it, but it's called the rocket problem. Basically, here's what the rocket problem involves. Say you build a rocket, okay, and you can, with your rocket, you can get 100 pounds up into outer space, into low Earth orbit, and now you're happy. You can deliver 100 pounds into low Earth orbit with your rocket. And then you go, well, I'm going to build a rocket twice as big. I should be able to get 200 pounds of payload up into space. Isn't that right? And the answer, no, that's wrong. Because what happens is, in making the rocket twice as big, the structure of the rocket has to be much heavier. But now when you add extra fuel, that extra fuel actually becomes payload. So you have to lift the extra fuel with your rocket that's only twice as big. So now you have to you're not going to get the end result is, the overall end result is by doubling the size of your rocket, you're not going to get twice the payload into space. And as you triple the size of your rocket, you're certainly not going to get three times. In fact, there's a diminishing return in what is known as the rocket problem. The bigger you build a rocket, the less you're going to get into outer space. Up to a certain point, you just can't make rockets any bigger. If you make them bigger and bigger and bigger, you're going to get like an ounce extra into space. So it's a point of no return. Okay, so realizing this, and then also realizing that once you get out into outer space, now you got to carry all your fuel with you. Say you want to go to Mars, Moon. Say you want to go to Jupiter. Say you want to go to the next star system. If you're using inertial rockets, you got to carry all this fuel with you. So the fuel becomes part of the burden of the payload. So now the payload that you can take is much less because you're taking all this extra fuel that you got to have for your long trip. Okay, so anyway, that's the dilemma. So that in a nutshell, what I said is, okay, there's got to be, God designed this universe, giving us all the tools we need to happily and successfully and easily travel through the universe without this burden of carrying all this stuff with us. And so I sat down and I go, self, there's got to be a way. So I came up with basically two non-inertial propulsion systems, and one of them is published or republished in the Atlantis to Tesla book, and it's just a reprinting of the IEEE publication that resulted from a talk I gave in 1986 at the 19th International Electric Propulsion Conference in Colorado Springs, Colorado. And by the way, that's not the first time I gave that discussion of this propulsion system. The original one, I was in the very early 1980s in Los Angeles looking for funding for this project and with venture capitalist groups there. And so I'd given this talk many times at the same talk I gave at the Airspace America Air Show in San Diego, somewhere in that same time frame. But the point is that the propulsion system is non-inertial. It does not throw something out. It's a magnetic propulsion system. And anyway, I could go on quite a bit, but the long discussion of propulsion systems all the way from the first airplanes and jet power propellers, etc., is in my paid cast. So go check that out. And so this is just a little primer to get you interested, and that will be a very long, detailed analysis. So once again, go to my webpage. The water filter products are there on sale, jmccsci.com. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour, and as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.